Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones, of course. I'm Eamon Clark, and returning from episode 249, Night of the Devil, it's a big warm welcome back to Jim O'Brien. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, and thank you very much for having me back. It's great to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure, Jim. We last time took a bit of a deep dive into Hugo Pratt in one of the Treasury collections that they put out, which was fascinating. We've got another fascinating artist to talk about today. Give us the introduction. What is the book for today's episode?
So the book that we've chosen today is When the Wind Blows, written and drawn by Raymond Briggs and published in 1982.
Indeed. I've got a 1983 Penguin edition. I think the first edition, I've forgotten who the publisher was. There was an American publisher for the first edition in 82.
Yeah.
And then a very popular UK paper.
Yeah. I've got the Hamish Hamilton edition.
So that's the one. Right.
And that's 1982. I was looking, funnily enough, at the sort of like the publishing details, and it says that it was the reprinted before publication, because it's got these sort of the very first page has got a whole list of quotes by the great and the good of the time, which presumably wouldn't have been in the very, very first edition, but that it was sort of reprinted to include those comments, I think. But yeah, so mine is Hamish Hamilton, hardback from 1982.
And I've got the 83 paperback, which, as you say, is filled with quotes at the start from various people about the importance of this book. I think we can say that Raymond Briggs is a sort of one-man band. He does it all, doesn't he? Covers, letters, everything.
The works. Yeah, absolutely right.
So first of all, Jim, why this one for the book club?
Well, I mean, yeah, good question, because honestly, if we were going to talk about Raymond Briggs, I think I could have happily picked any of his comic strip books. They are all fantastic, and I've known them all, you know, really well since I was a child. I had the pleasure of going along to Ditchling Museum about a year ago to see a retrospective devoted to Raymond Briggs' work. And they had all sorts of original art, including pages from When the Wind Blows. And it sort of struck me again what an amazing book it particularly is. Raymond Briggs was, I know he was famous for having, you know, saying that books weren't missiles. You didn't aim them at particular groups or readerships. But that said, When the Wind Blows, it does always strike me as an interesting one in his set of books, in that it's more obviously aimed at an adult readership than some of the previous titles and some of the later ones. So that makes it interesting. And weirdly, because I mean, obviously, for, you know, in the 1980s, When the Wind Blows was talking about what was potentially a future war, but I find it fascinating, actually, the way When the Wind Blows talks about World War II. When you introduced us just a moment ago, and I was thinking this is totally different from Hugo Pratt and Night of the Devil, maybe in one respect not so different, in that I seem to have come round to a book which yet again has something to do with World War II in it. So those are a bunch of reasons why I think, you know, it's a particularly interesting example of Raymond Briggs's work.
I was going to say that, you know, we hadn't chosen a war comic this time, but of course we have.
Accidentally.
Okay, for anybody who doesn't know, Jim, give us the quick synopsis or the outline of When the Wind Blows. What's this book about?
Yeah, so the story in a nutshell, we have a couple, Jim and Hilda Bloggs, who are retired. They live in a cottage in the countryside in Sussex, and they have very quiet, very uneventful lives. But as the story opens, we feel that we're on the verge of really serious international incidents leading potentially to the outbreak of war. And the narrative really concerns the way the Bloggses cope with the impending nuclear strike that's been threatened. And then in the second half of the book, living through the strike itself and coping with the desperate situation that faces them on the other side of Armageddon. And it's a we only see Jim and Hilda Bloggs. They're the only characters we see in the book. And there's a very, very tight focus on their lives and the house that they live in. The book rarely strays. There are key moments we'll maybe talk about where it moves beyond that, but it's a very, very tight focus on their domestic life as they prepare for and cope with nuclear war.
And we are, as you say, it's a very tight focus on Jim and Hilda. We're on the home front in a way, in terms of a war comic. We're seeing what the effect is on these very ordinary people.
Yeah, exactly so.
Tell us a little bit about Raymond Briggs, 1934 to 2022.
Yeah, a fascinating man, amazing career until 1973. I think he was working commercially as a book illustrator from the sort of mid 60s onwards, very successfully in the field of children's book illustration. Then this significant moment in the mid-70s where he began to use the comic strip format for children's books, the book in question being Father Christmas, which came out in 1973, I think it is, which was seen as being a very bold step at the time to sort of move away from traditional children's books with a number of illustrations around the text into sort of using a comic strip format for his titles. And from that moment on, I mean, it was so successful, Father Christmas, that he sort of kept with that format more or less through the rest of his career.
Yeah, I mean, fascinating that he had these big hits in the 1970s. As you say, Father Christmas, 1973, Fungus the Bogeyman, 1977. And then, of course, we have to mention The Snowman.
Yes.
1978, and yeah. Then gets made into the TV version, Christmas 1982. I believe that was on Channel 4 and becomes such a huge hit, doesn't it?
Absolutely massive hit. And yeah, it's funny because actually the Snowman is a wordless book. I mean, it's like a sequential story told in pictures, but there's no words at all. So it's in a way, it's an outlier in what Raymond Briggs did through most of his career, which are more, you know, traditional strip cartoons with speech bubbles and thought bubbles and so on. But yeah, the effect of the Snowman was so massive. And remains so massive to this day that it sort of propelled him into, a different category altogether. The category of national treasure, which I think in a way he wasn't always very at ease with. You know, he was someone who wasn't particularly comfortable being thought of in those terms. And that although I think he had a lot of affection for the Snowman, in a way it's quite atypical of his work because it is very... it's very gentle, it's very lyrical, there's very little darkness, where many of his other titles have an element of something a bit grittier, a bit more mordant about them. And so there's an irony, I think, to the fact that possibly The Snowman will remain his best-known work because it is in some ways the least representative, I think, of elements of him, but yeah, that's the way it goes, I suppose, isn't it? You can't predict how your career will be viewed by others.
It is absolutely fascinating that 1982 he publishes this book, which I guess was only a few months before he's about to be catapulted to Christmas national treasure status, as you say. And this is a very different book, as you say. So tell us a little bit, Jim, about Raymond Briggs's art style and his storytelling in this book, When the Wind Blows, in particular. I'm going to say there's quite a lot of panels, obviously.
You're so right there. That in itself is really interesting, I think, because if you do own any of his earlier picture books, including The Snowman, but Fungus the Bogeyman, Gentleman Jim, that we'll definitely talk about a bit more in a second, the Father Christmas books, they have very, very many fewer panels per page. And I think that the density of the panels in When the Wind Blows is really striking. What have you got? You've got sort of, I mean, I think every page has seven tiers, doesn't it? But I mean, you're talking sort of upwards of 20 to 30 panels on a page, really, really dense stuff. And I think partly, again, it's a reflection of the fact that he was aware that he was writing for, an adult audience, a more mixed audience than some of his children's picture books, and he wanted to give more. He wanted it to be a richer, more textured story, so he was going to need more space. And I think that the sort of the binding of the books limited him to the number of pages he was going to be able to produce. Therefore, he was looking, you know, could he get more panels on the page? I read somewhere that he'd seen a Swiss edition of the Snow, a Father Christmas, which miniaturized the pages and sort of packed information down onto a much, much smaller page. And it worked. And I think he was quite surprised that you could shrink the panels in Father Christmas and still tell the story, still see clearly what was going on. And he sort of took that as affirmation that, well, you know, do that for When the Wind Blows. Make the panels deliberately smaller. It's still legible, which I think it completely is. I don't think there's many pages where you feel you're not really getting what's going on because of the compaction of the panels. And it allows you to tell a longer story in the same number of pages. But it is remarkable when you open it up and look at the density and a lot of text as well. They're, you know, those speech bubbles are full.
I was particularly struck this time by the small panels sort of reflecting the minutiae of Jim and Hilda's lives, their preparations for this oncoming conflict,
yeah.
Them trying to follow government advice. And then, of course, he punctuates these pages full of panels with occasional what we'd call, I suppose, splash pages or larger features, which give us a hint at much bigger things that are happening in a way. Their preparations for the big one. It's a remarkable effect that he's achieved with this sort of comparison between small and large.
Yeah, it's a really nice effect, isn't it? That you, as you say, you get these double page spreads, sort of more monochrome images of a rocket preparing to be fired, a large aircraft taking off into the night sky, a submarine sort of cruising through the depths. And that it's a very regular kind of beat in the first half of the book sort of divides up really nicely into two halves. The first half, as you say, this sort of very steady, quiet look at Jim and Hilda's domestic lives with these little beats as we sort of see the preparations for war taking place on a distant plain in a distant sea in a distant sky, and it's very controlled. It's very, very sort of very effectively controlled for us as the reader to sort of build tension and ratchet up our sense of impending doom, I think.
And then, as you say, Jim, in the middle of the book, the big one goes off.
Yeah.
In quite devastating detail, but with remarkably, I mean, Raymond Briggs, again, he does something very brave in the middle of the book with the storytelling,
yeah,
about how he depicts a nuclear weapon affecting some part of Britain, apparently.
Yes, yes. No, you're right. It is, how do you show that? You know, how do you represent something so awesome, so monumental? And his answer, I suppose, is to sort of like you have a single, a double page spread, which is almost like a whiteout, isn't it? Where, you know, the bomb has gone off and there is nothing. There's just a white searing heat, just a little bit of pink at the corner of the pages, followed by a double page spread, which I think is absolutely magnificent, where the panels themselves have been like shaken to their very foundations. And we see them sort of appear from the white heat and gradually reform and sort of gain their rigidity again by the end of that double page spread, and the details come back into focus once more. And this, I think, if I remember my English literature sort of stuff at school, that it's bathos, isn't it, where you have something that is deliberately sort of anticlimactic. So we've got the bombs gone off, the whole world has been effectively sort of remade in this appalling Armageddon. And then the very last panel on that double page spread is Jim just saying, "Blimey," and it's a wonderful, wonderful way to sort of, you know, how do you show the nuclear strike? That's a pretty good way, I think.
And then the second half of the book I mean, it's absolutely incredible stuff. And we're going to come back and talk about that central part of the book again in a moment. But from then on, we are dealing with the literal fallout.
Yeah.
And how it's affecting Jim and Hilda. One of the things, of course, this book has to do is make us care for Jim and Hilda. And I think I can say that Raymond Briggs manages that remarkably. We just love the two characters and hope they're going to be all right. Spoilers, obviously, they're not going to be all right. But, I mean, again, you know, it is a remarkable piece of storytelling to make us care about this couple, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it's very fascinating because they are, Jim and Hilda are, to an extent, based on Raymond Briggs' own parents. He published a book in the very early 2000s, Ethel and Ernest, which was a sort of a biographical portrait of his parents. And to an extent, Jim and Hilda are kind of versions of them. I've read Raymond Briggs say that Jim and Hilda are more stupid than his parents, which sounds a very tough remark. I don't think possibly he meant that they're idiots, but that they're not well-educated people, Jim and Hilda. They're very, very trusting of authority. They're very deferential to those who, you know, have information about the nuclear strike and so on. And I think possibly as a reader, you can identify with that sense of being powerless, being very small in the face of these sort of monumental forces. But they're good people, I think, is the key, isn't it? Jim and Hilda they're good, decent, kind people, which makes us feel deeply for them. And sort of knowing that they are they're the least likely kind of people to sort of be able to take issue with what they're being told by the authorities at the time.
Absolutely. They are a delightful couple who, as you say, we feel for and hope for the best for them, even though, as I say, that's not going to happen. Yeah. You're quite right. They are very respectful of authority. And authority at this time, in the first half of this book, is telling them to do various things to prepare for a nuclear strike. And so we see them building the sort of doors leaning against the wall, shelter, and, you know, stocking up on tomato ketchup and so on. I wonder if you could say something about the 1980s, because obviously this is a 1982 comic book, I'm going to call it.
Yeah.
And in the 1980s, if I can quote from that, the title of those book series, Scarred for Life, we were all in the middle of a very understandable nuclear paranoia, weren't we?
Absolutely. No, completely right. And, I do think any of us who, you know, of a certain age who were growing up through that period, it was very remarkable, wasn't it? You know, that it saturated culture at that time. And One of the other reasons I've always been particularly interested in When the Wind Blows is I feel almost that I have a kind of connection to the book and what it's talking about in a couple of ways. Raymond Briggs was born in Wimbledon Park, and my dad grew up about a mile and a half from Raymond Briggs's birthplace. And at the same time, my dad's in his 90s now, and he was born, I think, just a year before Raymond Briggs. They never met. They went to different schools. But I like to entertain the fantasy that they may have queued up in the same newsagents for comics as young boys in Wimbledon. And then many years later, when this book was in preparation, Raymond Briggs apparently saw a Panorama documentary sort of about, you know, how the country should prepare for nuclear war. Someone in the village that I grew up in Surrey obviously saw either that Panorama or something very similar and was galvanized and thinking, you know, we've got to prepare. It's coming. The Soviets are going to strike soon. We've got to get ready, and sort of rallied round the people of our village to sort of think about what would we do, you know, when the bomb struck. And my dad got hauled into sort of, he was going to be the catering officer, basically. That once the strike had happened, that he would sort of go into action preparing, you know, soup for all the people in the village and so on. Although no one was laughing about nuclear war and its possibility in 1982, I think my brother and my sister and I found it hilarious to think that my dad was going to be in charge of providing food for everybody because he didn't do much cooking at home. We couldn't see it working out. But yeah, I mean, the subject in the 1980s was something that I was obviously intensely aware of. And it was all over the place in comics, in novels, TV, films, and so on. It was a dreadful, dreadful possibility that seemed very, very close.
Indeed. Now, I mentioned in our notes television and film like The Day After, Threads on the BBC in 1984, the film War Games, the BBC film The War Game. I even put in Two Tribes, where Frankie goes to Hollywood from 1984.
Yeah.
I was at Lawless this weekend and I was chatting to a chap called Keith Gainham, who runs the Strontium Dog Facebook page. And he, of course, said, well, the other nuclear paranoia at the time was in the pages of 2000 AD and Star-Lord. You had Strontium Dog. You had Johnny Alpha and the mutants are a sort of post-apocalyptic, post-nuclear apocalyptic story. Yeah. It was very much... as you say, a sort of fear at the time that it was going to be when, not if.
Yeah.
How do you think this particular book, When the Wind Blows, by Briggs, fits into that public perception of the idea of nuclear war?
Yeah, I think, as I say, one of the things that's really interesting in it is that Jim and Hilda, in their simplicity, in their naivety about nuclear war and what it would be like, they have no conception. They can't conceive of what a nuclear exchange will be compared to the kind of warfare that they'd obviously lived through as younger people, the Second World War. So it's a constant theme in the book that Jim and Hilda sort of hark back to the Second World War and imagine that the nuclear war of the future will be like that, a bit bigger, a bit more scientific. Jim's always, you know, he's very kind of like confident that science will save the day. But also it means that, yes, warfare will be bigger, but it will be a retread of the Second World War. And it's one of the, I suppose it's one of the grim ironies of the book is that we knew possibly even then, and certainly we know subsequently, that was not going to be the case. If there was a nuclear exchange, it would be indescribably worse than the Second World War, the Blitz. And that, you know, all the sort of preparations that Jim and Hilda make for the bomb are hopeless. I mean, they're entirely without sort of merit, really. That the whole thing about fallout, that in the book, Jim and Hilda don't really understand what fallout is. They think it must be something like snow. They don't really understand what it will mean to live through fallout and the nuclear winter that will follow. And I think that's very, that sort of thing that the book captures is very true to that time where people had limited sense of what was going on. To go back to my dad in the village and sort of being prepared to, you know, to run the soup kitchen for everybody, the booklet that he still got to this day that was prepared for them to sort of get ready had a Bruce Bairnsfather cartoon from the First World War on the front of it. And that kind of says everything, you know, don't worry so much about the nuclear war. It'll be like World War II or World War I, but a bit bigger. No, it won't. It's going to be awful.
Yeah, I mean, they do, as you say, refer back to World War II quite a lot. We get quite a lot of imagery as Jim and Hilda talk about World War II and living in shelters for a while and stuff like that. And this idea that, yeah, it will be, we've lived through, you know, the country has lived through that, therefore we can survive a nuclear holocaust.
Yeah.
As you say, their simplicity and their belief that authorities will get things right. There's a wonderful quote on the first page that I'm struck by where Jim says, the decisions made by the powers that be will get to us in the end, which sort of sadly lays out the whole book in a way, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful quote that you've just picked out, and I think it's very indicative of the way that Jim is in the story, that he mimics the sort of official speak, but often with these sort of malapropisms thrown in. So he gets terminology tumbled up and turned the wrong way round, or you know, selects words that are not quite correct, and you know, masterful. Raymond Briggs, I think, and is a tremendous artist, but actually, I think as a storyteller as well, and as a writer of dialogue, he's fantastic. The line that you've just quoted, and there's another one further on where they're talking. Hilda says, "Oh my goodness, is our insurance fully paid up?" And Jim says, yes, our funerals are fully assured." And again, there's a sort of like grim black comedy to his pronouncement.
Yeah, wonderful quotes throughout the book. As you say, a lot of dialogue because Jim and Hilda are telling us the story, basically. His writing is superb. His ear for their sort of voices is superb. And then, as you say, we do get these sorts of occasional bits where they're telling us what's going to happen to them, even though what's going to happen is terrible.
Yeah.
Plus, of course, his wonderful artistic style, which is at times both comforting and reassuring, and then at other times it's just awful.
Yeah.
The horror.
Yes. And I think if you sort of flick through the book, the first half is very colourful. It's very bright. The interiors of the Bloggs' home, you know, you've got these like strong greens and oranges and blues. It's very cheerful and upbeat. And then in the second half of the book, once the bomb has gone off and the colour gradually leaches out of all the panels, and we're left, the Bloggs themselves go from sort of a healthy pink to a sort of ghastly greenish white as the radiation sickness takes hold of them, and their whole world sort of loses its color, so that the final few pages are really very, very pale, pallid, gruesome. The very last page then sort of becoming almost like a fade to black, you know, as they reach the very end of their lives. And interestingly, that's the only page, I think, in the book where you get the panel arrangement is, it suddenly becomes absolutely steady. You've got 1, 2, 3, yes, seven tiers made up of four panels in a very regular grid. And it's the first time in the book that's happened. Up until that point, it's much more varied. And then as the heartbeat slows and it becomes very, very steady, it's a really powerful way of actually sort of symbolizing what's going on in the narrative, just in the way it's laid out on the page, which is brilliant, I think.
The colouring choices are remarkable, as you say. Very bright and cheerful at the start of the book, and then almost fungus to bogeyman, horrific colouring as the
absolutely. Oh, you're quite right. You're quite right. Yeah.
Now, I was very taken by the book you've already mentioned, Ethel and Ernest, a story about Raymond Briggs's parents, and that was made into an animated feature as well. Yeah. You also wanted to mention Gentleman Jim, which I don't think I'm familiar with. I can't recall that one.
Yeah, Gentleman Jim, it came out a couple of years before When the Wind Blows, and it too features Jim and Hilda Bloggs. It's very much like a companion piece to When the Wind Blows. We see Jim; he's still working as a toilet cleaner, a toilet attendant, and dreaming of other more adventurous lives he could have led if he'd not ended up cleaning loos. And it, in Briggsian fashion, his dreams of adventure don't end well. You know, he sort of fantasizes about being a much more glamorous figure than he is in real life. And it leads him into all sorts of trouble. And again, it's this desperate sense of a good and decent man falling foul of faceless bureaucracy, petty-minded officials who grind him and Hilda down. He ends up sort of becoming a highwayman, or, you know, he gets a knackered old donkey. Hilda designs him a sort of highwayman's outfit out of an old curtain. He buys a sort of rubber sword from a toy shop, goes out to have adventures and then, you know, ends up in prison. And it's highly humorous, but there is a very, very bleak sense of the inevitability of these things for people who mean well. You know, it's a great book. I would really recommend Gentleman Jim to anybody. It does similar things to When the Wind Blows. It also does this thing of having very steady panels and then these occasional splash pages where Jim imagines he's a secret agent or imagine he's an artist in Paris, imagines he's saving damsels in distress during World War II, ironically again. But yeah, it's a brilliant book.
I mentioned that Ethel and Ernest became an animated feature. Of course, there was an animated movie version of When the Wind Blows in 1986 with British acting royalty, John Mills and Peggy Ashcroft as the voices of Jim and Hilda.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to... I saw it when it came out, but I don't think I've seen it more recently, I'm afraid.
Yes, I've seen it not that long ago, and I still think it's... I still think it's not bad, actually. I think the way the animators in the film have managed to capture, you know, much of the look of Raymond Briggs' art, I think is very effective. It uses a little bit of model work as well. It's sort of straight up drawn animation, but they also incorporate a little bit of sort of Wallace and Gromit style model work in some sequences. And I think John Mills and Peggy Ashcroft are very, very good. Do you know what? Actually, I was thinking that because there was a radio play version of When the Wind Blows, which came out, I think, probably in about 1983 with Peter Salis as Jim and Brenda Bruce as Hilda. And
that blimey.
That's
right.
Really, really good. That's excellent. It was the Wallace and Gromit link that made me think of Peter Salis. But yeah, I think it's pretty effective, the film. It certainly leaves you with a lump in your throat at the end. You know, it is very moving, particularly the end.
I can imagine. And I've seen Ethel and Ernest more recently, and that also leaves you with a terrible lump in your throat at the end as well.
Yeah.
It's a very moving book and film about his parents.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let me turn you back to When the Wind Blows by Raymond Briggs. Let's play Grail Pages, Jim. Now, I know you've picked out a few pages to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. The first, I mean, yeah, as always, and I know your other guests on the show always have this problem that there's you're spoilt for choice, whichever book has been picked. But I think the one I would go for is the very, very center of the book, when the bomb has gone off, and as the sort of shock dies away, we get this double page spread where the panels begin to reform and take back their shape again. And it's the blimey page, as we were saying. It's where you get there's no other speech on the page. The bomb has gone off, and then you just hear Jim at the bottom say "blimey," and I think it's such a magnificent thing, you know, how in it, comics is uniquely placed to do that thing successfully, of like the format of the panels show you the impact of what's going on in the world it's describing. I think it's terrific, that page.
It is a stunning spread from the middle of this book. It's literally stunning in the lives of Jim and Hilda, but it is so beautifully done.
Yeah.
After two blank pages of the explosion, and then, as you say, Raymond Briggs's masterful use of just like the panel borders, the panels themselves, blown to pieces, disrupted, shaking, and slowly, slowly reforming or settling. Yeah. Such a clever bit of storytelling and artwork.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think it's absolutely fabulous. By contrast, the other Grail page that I would love to choose from this, further on into the narrative, as we're drawing towards the end of the book, and Jim and Hilda fearfully imagine what it might be like if Soviet forces arrived in the UK, an occupying army. And again, they do this kind of thing of really being unable to conceive of real Soviet armed divisions arriving, but they conceive of it in terms of like Cossack warriors from World War II. And there's this magnificent page where you've got the steady panels that we've been talking about, but this sort of splash page image of a huge mustachioed Russian soldier with sort of machine gun in his hand, skis on his back, appearing out of the snow to confront Jim and Hilda. And I think that's a wonderful page. He does this at several points in the book, both in the first half when you're getting ready for the nuclear strike, and in the second half when it's happened, where there are these bigger images inserted in amongst the panels. One, I meant to mention it earlier because I know you, Eamon, have an interest in the work of Carl Giles.
Yes,
and the earlier on in the book where there's a picture of Monty and there's a picture of Hitler and Goering and Goebbels, sort of caricature as Jim and Hilda recall World War II. And I only learned about this really, really recently, that Raymond Briggs wanted to sort of literally mimic Giles's caricatures of the Nazi leaders and of Mussolini, and had actually written to him to say, you know, would it be possible to kind of deliberately use his imagery in the book? And I think Giles was quite up for it, but apparently Mirror newspapers have said, no way, that's not happening. And had sort of drawn a line under that. So you get, they are Raymond Briggs's caricatures of the Nazi leaders, but based on Carl Giles's kind of wartime cartooning, which I thought was a fascinating glimpse. I'd never understood that before, but that's lovely.
Oh, I didn't know that. That is very interesting. What a shame that he couldn't get to do a little bit of Giles himself, because that would be a lovely comparison. But it's very, you know, shame on the newspapers for not allowing it. But there you go.
Indeed, yeah.
The page with the Soviet warrior is absolutely fascinating, as Jim is describing a fantasy situation that almost becomes real with this figure dominating the page and Jim recoiling in fear from it. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So we will grant you those absolutely extraordinary Grail pages. I might nick the cover, the front cover.
Yeah.
Of course. My Penguin version for, because Jim and Hilda with a tray of tea and all these big events going on around them is just such a wonderful image as well.
Yeah. Yeah, no, very nice. And I know the cover that you have. Mine's a little different. It still has Jim and Hilda with the mushroom cloud sort of behind them as the bomb goes off. One thing I particularly like about my cover, the hardback one, is that the font, the typeface they use for Raymond Briggs's name and for the title of the book is that what I call, like, it's a countdown font. It's got that sort of, it's that sort of computer lettering that, you know, any comic in the sort of, well, probably from the 60s up to the 80s used if it was trying to talk about the future or about sort of science. You'd use that kind of countdown font that looks like it's come out of a computer printout, which I've always thought was a nice little touch on the cover that I've got. But yeah, I like your cover very much. I know it.
I was going to say that there are a few covers. I'm looking at the cover to your edition now, and as you say, focuses much more in on just Jim and Hilda, but also that wonderful font that they've used,
yeah,
which was all the rage at the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fantastic stuff. Well, obviously, When the Wind Blows is an eternal classic, so it's still in print and fairly easy to get copies of. I've got this rather battered Penguin from 1982, which has obviously been in my family for a while because the binding is starting to go on it. You've still got the hardback, which is nice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm pleased, super pleased that somehow I've got hardbacks of that one, Gentleman Jim, and various others. But yeah, so I think, and I've got a paperback Father Christmas here, which definitely is the one that we had as children. That somehow managed to make it through. Well, it's got a few scribbles in it, but there you go.
So if you only know the work of Raymond Briggs from The Snowman and Father Christmas, check out When the Wind Blows from 1982, because it is just the most remarkable piece of work. And I'm going to have to go back and check out Gentleman Jim again, I think, Jim, see if I've actually come across that one. I'm going to have to get a copy.
Yeah, no, I think you'd really enjoy that.
I look forward to it. And of course, Ethel and Ernest is also highly recommended by us both, I'm going to say.
Absolutely. Yeah, quite so. I think that really is a masterpiece.
Great stuff, Jim. Thank you so much for picking it and coming back on the book club. We turn from nuclear paranoia of the 80s to guest projects and hopefully more cheerful stuff in a way. I know you are, or that your writing has appeared in another issue of Battling Britons from Justin Marriott. Issue 7 was out not all that long ago, I'm going to say, and you're in that one, I believe.
Yes, I am. I've got a few pieces in that. Must have been, yes, it must be about sort of 2-3 months back, something of that sort.
And yeah.
Justin has planned to put out another edition of Comics Rule OK, which I think he's intending to publish sort of towards the end of the autumn as we go into wintertime. The plan being, I believe, to make it an all-colour edition rather than the black and white issues that he's put out so far. And so I'm busy preparing pieces for that, getting a chance to talk about and hopefully, you know, reproduce panels from color comics of the sort of 70s and 80s. So I'm fired up with what we might be able to do with that. On my desk at the moment, I've got a stack of books and some notes to do with the New English Library comic magazine from the early 70s called Dracula, which sort of featured Spanish art on horror and sort of fantasy themes. And I'm sort of trying to draw together a piece on that and on sort of comic strip adaptations of the Avengers, the British Avengers, the TV Avengers with Steed and so on. So that's the two essays that are bubbling away in my head just at the moment.
Oh, that Dracula comic from the 70s. You and I have talked about that off air, I think. And one of the slight problems, of course, is it's quite difficult to find a copy now.
It is. It's weird how these things go, because even a few years ago, you could pick up copies relatively easily. And they do seem to have become like the proverbial hen's teeth and, with price tags to match. So, yeah, it's not as accessible as it should be, unfortunately.
Yeah, shame. Obviously, in Battling Britain 7, I know you're writing about the artist Louis Bermeo, but also you wrote fascinatingly about comic depictions of the German occupation of the Channel Isles, which is another interesting callback to World War II. A bit of fascinating history there.
Yeah, no, really, really, really interesting theme. And it was... I can see why, you know, for British audiences, that the Channel Islands were, you know, the only part of Crown territory that was occupied during the war. And, you know, as a group of islands, it has a sort of very obvious symbolism for Great Britain as an island itself. But yeah, the way those stories play out was really interesting. As is always the case, you know, I get very heavily into sort of researching things, and I think I've found everything that you could possibly talk about in relation to a topic. It goes to print, and then almost immediately you find a bunch more comics that deal with it, some in really interesting ways, and you sort of think, oh, if only I'd held off for a couple more months, I could have really done the business on that. But that's the way life is.
Well, yes, you always find more stuff after the publication date.
Yeah.
I wish I'd known more about the Carl Giles connection before, you know, with Raymond Briggs, but there you go. That was something that I learnt from you.
Yeah.
Follow the links in the show notes to Battling Britons issue 7, or just search Amazon for Justin Marriott, and usually you'll find his various publications popping up, Paperback Fanatic, Battling Britons, and of course Comics Rule OK. Great stuff, Jim. Well, I look forward to more of your fascinating articles. I also look forward to what interesting and eclectic choice you'll pick for next year's visit to the book club.
I'm on it already, Eamon. I'm going to go away and have a good think. And like I say, I thought I'd been very clever and picked something entirely different from Hugo Pratt and World War II. not so. As we've seen, this book also has a good link to the Second World War. I will really do my best next time round to move away from the war. Famous last words.
Yeah, we'll see. Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you too.
And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. Find the links that we've been talking about at megacitybookclub.com. See the images from Raymond Briggs that we've been talking about on the socials of Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, Mastodon, Substack, and the 2000 AD forums. And email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, if you've got a book, a creator, or a story that you'd like to come on and talk about. So until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, from me, it's goodbye and...
Goodbye from me too, and many, many thanks.
Thanks.